So you're driving on I-84 and you enter the city of Yakima. And there to welcome you is this big white sign with red and green and black lettering. And it reads, "Welcome to Yakima, the Palm Springs of Washington." Now, this is not the official slogan. In fact, we reached out to the tourist board in Yakima, and they have nothing to do with it. Their official slogan is "The Heart of Central Washington." And this, while in some ways more defensible, is definitely less punchy. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and we were wondering, who decided it was the Palm Springs of Washington? So it turns out it was this guy.
I said, how about we put the Palm Springs of Washington on it? And he goes, geez, that's great. That sounds good. And why would you come up with something like that? Well, it might attract interest.
That's Gary Lukehart, and he's lived in Yakima forever. And in 1986, in honor of the town's 100th birthday, he put up a sign celebrating the centennial. He owns property along the highway, so he can do that sort of thing. But then it was 1987, and he thought, well, it's not the centennial anymore. I should probably change what the sign says. But why call Yakima the Palm Springs of Washington? I mean, what does that even mean?
The purpose of it was really to say, hey, we have a nice warm climate in Yakima, Washington, and lots of sunshine, 300 days a year. And there's several ways of saying that. And I lived in Los Angeles for a few years. And even when it got foggy and smoggy in the wintertime, we'd drive an hour or so over to Palm Springs, and it was always beautiful. And that's what we have in common, I guess, with Palm Springs in California.
So that's it. It's sunnier, and if you live out here in Western Washington and maybe get a little tired of the winter or the spring or the June gloom, well, Gary says, come on out to Yakima. But the guy behind this memorable slogan did not expect this to become a thing, and it has. There's a Yakima Palm Springs of Washington Facebook page. If you look at Yakima's Wikipedia page, the Palm Springs of Washington is the first nickname listed above the official one. And the people who live there, well, they seem to like the nickname, mostly.
Really, you know, there's a few people that don't like it at all. But most of the comments that I've heard are positive.
Gary says no one's ever vandalized the sign or anything. And so far, he just hasn't heard a good reason to take it down.
Sometimes when people talk to me about it, I just say, what would you put on the sign? And most of them don't have any idea. They say, well, I'll think about it. Well, I says, when you come up with a better idea, give me a call.
Today on Sound Effect, we are talking about names. Our names, other people's, how we choose them, and why we sometimes change them. But first, we're joined by some big-name journalists to help us run down the news of the week. So stick around. Well, I'm just going to jump right in here and start naming names. Barrett Anderson is co-founder and CEO of the Seattle-based sci-fi and technology media startup Scout. Mike Lewis is acting online managing editor for KPLU, and Andrea Otanes teaches journalism and communications at the University of Washington. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Thanks
for having us.
So we're going to be talking over the news this week, and this week, lawmakers in Olympia got started on their second special session trying to craft a budget, and this time they did it in Jay Inslee's office, with the governor standing cross-armed over them, glaring down. At least that's how I imagine it. And all the while, they're making preparations for a possible government shutdown at the end of the month. Temporary layoff notices went out to a bunch of state workers. So this is where we find ourselves. I guess my first question is, what is this, actual drama or kabuki theater? Barrett Anderson, maybe we could start with you.
Sure. I mean, I think we've seen this in past years. People like to wait until the last minute to get things done, just like high schoolers or college students turning in their papers. And the legislature has done the same thing over and over. I really have no doubt that they'll pass a budget by July 1st.
Is there any incentive to not go down to the wire?
A little bit. I think it would make things easier for them in terms of political pressure, perhaps, if they did it a little earlier. They also wind up paying for the special session, and that'll come out of their budgets.
That's true. It's not free. Mike Lewis, what do you think? Actual drama or kabuki theater?
It's probably a little bit of both. I mean, this is the way state budgets are passed in every state in the union. If there's a deadline, they push to the deadline. And the weird effect on a deadline is that it actually ramps up political pressure. And so deals are much more likely to be cut when the pressure is on, and people even in business know this. So I actually don't, I'm rarely surprised. I'm more surprised that everyone refers to a budget impasse as a surprise. This is pro forma as far as the State House goes.
Yeah, Andrea, that your experience as well, this is basically how it goes each time around.
Yeah, and I find myself actually giving them the benefit of the doubt, which may be an unpopular position.
You're the only one.
But... I know. But you're looking at all the different complicated things they've got to do with McCleary and 1351 and all of that. There's a fair amount of stuff to wade through. So, I mean, it is pretty ridiculous. I don't think there'll be a government shutdown. You know, I don't. I think everybody wants to get to the U.S. Open. So
that's the real deadline.
Yeah, exactly.
Mike Lewis.
This is the politics of abundance, right? I mean, this is a very different thing than when you're facing a massive budget shortfall. And so this is more carving up a pie that everyone agrees is there. And so that makes it a little bit easier as far as the negotiations go. This is not going to be a budget of austerity, even under the GOP proposals. So I think this is going to be a little bit easier at the deadline than a normal budget would be.
Well, and as we've approached the deadline, the revenue projections have gotten rosier. So it's
absolutely
like they're getting more money just by sitting around waiting.
Right.
And in that sense, maybe it's to their benefit to wait till the very last minute.
Yeah, and I think it's especially been to Republicans' benefit because they've been anti-new taxes all along. And the growing budget projections have actually, you know, been kind of a downside for Democrats who have been trying to push for a capital gains tax.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Barrett, because that is a point that Seattle Times columnist Danny Westneat made this week, that the Republicans are kind of in the saddle right now because of those growing budget projections, and that's let them sit back and, you know, it's kind of played into their hands a little bit.
The other part of that is that Republicans have also, as Danny wrote, put forward a more moderate transportation package. And I think what you've seen this year is Republicans really kind of out-bargaining Democrats in a lot of ways. They've managed to come forward as a more reasonable front, and they've really just stonewalled Democrats on most of the things that they've wanted in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I wonder the last tax that it's still on the table, it seems, last big one anyways, this capital gains tax. Is there any sense of, can we handicap the chances of that at this point? I mean, the Democrats need to come away with something, right?
Well, it seems like the latest thing I've heard is the capital gains tax will go away. It's not going to happen. Instead, the Republicans will go for closing a loophole. That'll come back on the table.
And that'll be a little fig leaf for Democrats?
Yeah. Exactly.
Very, very little fig leaf. What I thought was interesting also is that the GOP found religion on a non-religious issue in education, and that it's not functioning as a standard opposition party, a minority opposition party. It's functioning as a party with some ideas, at least as it relates to education and independent proposals, which is not as conventional, like Danny sort of referenced in his column.
And you mean Danny Westneat?
Danny Westneat. It's not a conventional position for the minority party. And it's I think it's put them in really, not only in good light, but it's made it much more interesting for the Democrats to have to actually deal with a real proposal that is not just designed to get them to vote against something, but is actually get them to negotiate something.
They're sort of setting the agenda instead of just
reacting.
Absolutely. Okay, that's our top story for the week. Now we're going to move into our undercovered stories of the week. Andrea Otanas, let's start with you. What's your underreported story?
All of these bills passed in the session, and there they sit all lined up waiting to affect people's lives. But once that ends, you know, where's the momentum? You know, there's a lot of stuff that's going to go into effect. How's it going to change my life? I'd like to know that. So,
you'd like some reporting on that.
I would, and I hate to be a complainer. I know how busy everybody is and
we're
all that kind of
stuff. We're inviting
you to complain. But it just seems like some mo is lost just because the legislators have seemingly, well, they've gone behind closed doors. I don't know that their mo is gone, but where's the reporter mo, right? I want to hear more about what's going on. Get out and prognosticate. What does it look like when tuition is cut? What does that mean for a university? Is it true that fewer classes are offered? And I know they're going to backfill, but how does that backfill work? You know, what is not going to get funded if the Republicans are going to backfill tuition?
Barrett Anderson, what is your undercovered story of the week?
Yeah, so my undercovered story this week was a report that came out of the AP, which is that the FBI is actually flying surveillance planes all over the U.S., low-flying planes that can listen to your cell phone calls.
And these planes, is Seattle one of the places that the planes are buzzing with their surveillance equipment?
Yeah, so one of the places that they identified was they were flying directly over Seattle.
Okay.
And I think people knew this was happening. The underreported part of this was the fact that these planes are actually registered under secret companies and secret identities. So no one really knows which ones are surveillance planes or not. The AP actually declined the FBI's request not to disclose the company names and disclose those names because they said that they were public record and so therefore anyone could find out. But I think this points to a bigger question and a bigger trend, which is people are a little, more than a little, unsatisfied with the amount of disclosure they're getting about government surveillance programs on a national level. And that affects us a lot here in Seattle because, A, we're undergoing these same surveillance programs, but B, there's a huge core of tech companies here that are actually really being harmed by these policies. In the European Union, people are not comfortable with American companies any longer because of government, U.S. government policies. And they're actually forcing like major companies like Amazon and Microsoft to have servers actually in the EU or else they won't use these companies. So, I mean, it's a little bit of a stretch to get there, but I think you see a lot of these surveillance news bits bubbling up and there's been a real sea change in how people think about surveillance.
So next time you look up and you see those small planes, look carefully at the wing. And all the company names are like weird, innocuous things, yeah, like PLX Services or whatever. Yeah. All right, well, thanks for that undercovered story. Mike Lewis, your turn. What's your undercovered story?
My undercovered story is the same as my overcovered one, which is housing prices here in Seattle. I think the issue is that we get a lot of housing prices are going up stories, and we get it reported almost in a sports agate kind of form. Like, here's what it was, here's what it is, this is the median price. But we don't do as much on an individual's capacity to afford living in town anymore and what it means sort of collaterally on the culture within a town. I mean, for example, you talk to anyone in a band in Seattle and there's no band practice space available. You talk to people in galleries and artists, they don't have studio space. They don't have gallery space. And I'm not suggesting it's just an arts thing. This goes across a variety of strata in the city. And so, I mean, housing prices are a canary, one canary in the coal mine, but hardly the only one. And I think that the reporting on it is worthwhile, but I don't think that it's complete. And until you find out what a service industry worker or a cook in a restaurant, or let's just say someone who is on the wait staff in a Tom Douglas place, which probably is on the higher end of the scale, and how their ability, what the percentage of their income is to afford an apartment that is not two towns away, I think that's when you start actually getting into a town. And then you go from there and say, okay, what is this town going to look like in 10 years if this trend continues? And if you want to know what it's going to look like, I suggest you go to San Francisco.
Indeed. Barrett Anderson?
The group that gets really left out is the middle income people.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that Seattle hasn't really dealt with yet and is going to have to continue to think about and plan for.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point.
All right. So with that, let's move into our overcovered stories. Andrea Otanis, what's your overcovered story?
This is actually rooted in a moment in reading the paper last Sunday. There was a really interesting story on the business front about bycatch and trawlers versus longline and halibut. Story by Hal Burton and Justin Mayo, really interesting look at that industry. And I just happened on it because I was flipping through the paper, but in the front there was no tease to it. And the teases were, and this is very specific to the paper, were some millennial lifestyle stories across the top, two of them, and then a story about space. And I thought, this is off. I want to know this news. Give me one tease. So I guess my overreported story is millennial lifestyles. I'm done. You know, give me one. Give me a little flavor. You got to bring the readers in. But that's an interesting story about where our food comes from and what is happening with trawlers out there.
All right. Well, thanks for that. And Barrett Anderson, let's wrap it up with you. What is your overcovered story?
Yeah. So my overcovered story this week was a report that came out of Crunchbase, which aggregates all information about startup companies across the country. And there was this report that came out. They took all of their data and tried to break down their founders into male founders and female founders.
This is startup companies, venture-backed startup companies?
Yeah, venture-backed startup companies. And Seattle, it turned out, you know, wasn't at the top of that list in terms of the number of female founders. We were 14th out of all the cities that they ranked. And for me, this is an overreported story because, A, I think that's true. And I think that's a very, you know, it's an interesting trend and an issue that will continue to affect the culture here and the startup scene here. But B, I don't think that's news. I mean, it's not new. It's useful to see where we stand between other cities. I don't think that's really the bottom line. What we should be focusing on is how do we improve that number and what does that look like?
So is the overreported part of this covering this story like it was 10 years ago?
I think the overreported part is focusing on where Seattle fits into the national landscape, because I don't think that that's as important as the bigger trend, which is that female founders are actually increasing. But we do have a ways to go. And I think if I were to focus on and report on this story, I would focus on what could we do to get there rather than just where we stand and really diving into that over and over again.
All right. Well, you've been listening to our news roundup here on Sound Effect. In a moment, we're going to be getting into our show all about naming names. And I can't let you guys go without hearing. Barrett, you got a new name this weekend. What was it exactly?
Yeah, I went to a summer camp this weekend in Mendocino County where it's a summer camp for grownups. And they give you a new name. And my name was Tree Star from The Land Before Time.
Well, Tree Star Barrett Anderson is co-founder and CEO of the Seattle-based sci-fi and technology media startup Scout. Mike Lewis is acting online managing editor here at KPLU. Andrea Otanes teaches journalism and communication at the University of Washington. Thank you guys so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hello?
Could I please speak to Gabriel Spitzer?
This is Gabriel Spitzer. Hey, Gabriel. Or should I call you Gabe? Which one do you prefer?
You know, either one. We're going to get to that, actually. Don't get ahead of me, Gabe. So, sorry. Gabe, how long have we known each other, would you say?
I'd say 7 or 8 years at this point.
Yeah, easy. And actually, I've known about you for even longer than that from cyberstalking you. How would you describe the nature of our relationship?
Definitely a lot of mistaken emails and some cross-Googling for sure.
Definitely. Well, in case you're wondering, this is Gabriel Spitzer talking with my doppelganger, Gabriel Spitzer, here on Sound Effect from KPLU. And, you know, we swapped a lot of misdirected emails over the years. Your email is gabespitzer@xyz. Mine is gabrielspitzer@xyz. But people seem to mix them up a lot, especially me.
You tend to email me when you think you're emailing yourself sometimes. That's happened quite a bit.
So many times. I've just did a little search in my email a day or two ago, just because I knew I was going to be chatting with you. This is the first time we've talked, by the way, on the phone.
It is.
And I was shocked and embarrassed at how many times I have messed this up.
I feel like I know your family pretty well at this point, because I think I've had baby pictures. I've been on email chains with your family. So I feel like I know you, even though, it's only been a cyber relationship.
Right. And I did get a note from your mom once reminding you to call Omi.
That's true. I haven't always been the best at calling Omi, but that's a good reminder.
So, Gabe, I've got like so many questions I've always wanted to ask you. And I think the reason that I want to ask you these questions is that you're a bit of a parallel universe. You are me in a parallel universe. And so I'm wondering how stuff for me that's, you know, played out in a certain way has played out for you. So first of all, like how has the name treated you?
It's been a good name. Yeah. Going way back, for 1 week of my life, my name was Peter Gabriel Spitzer. And then a week later, you know, Peter Gabriel being the singer, which my parents didn't know at that time. And a week later, they changed it. So, you know, since being 1 week old, it's treated me pretty well. How about you?
It's okay. It's a little hard to pronounce sometimes on the radio, I guess. You know, you think it's fine until you get in front of a microphone and you have to say Gabriel.
I'll point out, too, because I almost always go by Gabe. Every time I say it, people think I'm saying Dave. So that's been a frustrating part of my life.
That was my next question for you. When you introduce yourself as Gabe, do people say, Dave, nice to meet you?
Exactly. And then I have to say Gabriel. Yeah.
That is,
you know, a lot of Starbucks cups with Dave written on them as well.
Have you had embarrassing nicknames over the years?
Gabey the Baby. That's definitely one. How about you?
Well, that I've had that one as well. Although that has occasionally morphed into Gabe the Babe, which I like better.
That's a good one. I will point out, too, that many, many times my parents have had their friends come up to them and say how proud they must be that, you know, their son does public radio for NPR. and then they have to sheepishly explain that, no, I'm the, that's someone else.
As recently as 1 week ago, I had done a few weeks back, I had done a story for this show about a fascinating project called the Urban Death Project, where a woman has plans to create facilities where people can compost their loved ones after they die. Mm. And I heard back from her, and she said, by any chance did you grow up in Norwich, Vermont, and go to cross school? Yeah. And I said, no, I'll bet you're thinking of my, you know, my doppelganger, Gabe. And then I got a note back from somebody else. I'm just going to read the relevant portions of it to you. I taught French to Gabriel when he was in 4th, 5th, and 6th grades at Cross School in Norwich, Vermont. Please tell him that Madame Kelly sends a jolly bonjour. Ask him if he remembers Monsieur and Madame Thibault, who live on Place d'Italie in Paris.
I definitely remember all those people. I was about to say, is that from Madame Kelly? That is very funny. Monsieur and Madame Thibault, I remember them as well. Yeah, for sure.
So as you can hear, the coincidence of sharing a slightly unusual name with another guy, it's not exactly altered my life's course. But if you're a politician, your name is your brand, and name recognition is everything. So in Pierce County, there's an elected official who discovered that having another well-known person around town with the exact same name is actually a really good way to raise your own name's profile. But as KPLU's Paula Whistle tells us, it also increases the chance that people will just get confused about who you actually are. So she brings us this story about two guys in the South Sound who are both named Derek Young.
In the interest of clarity, since we're talking about two people with the same name, I'll call the first Derek Young, Derek the Blogger. You see, he writes the Exit 133 blog, which covers Tacoma and Pierce County politics. The second Derek Young, and by the way, they both spell Derek, D-E-R-E-K, I'll refer to as Derek the Councilman because, well, he's on the Pierce County Council. According to Derek the Blogger, their two lives have been, in his words, merged like crazy.
There are elected officials and other people in the community who, when they talk to their smartphone and tell Siri or Cortana, call Derek Young, I'm often the one it calls. And so they'll be in their car, or they'll be in some office, and they'll just start talking, and I'm like, whoa, stop. Am I the right one?
Even his smart device gets confused.
My own phone. But every time I like reload it or recreate it, it merges me and the other Derek Young. And so his photos start showing up on all of my emails.
Now, these mix-ups have been going on for years. For his part, Derek Young, the councilman, found out about his name twin a decade ago when he was on the Gig Harbor City Council. He says he started getting these odd calls from Tacoma politicians asking for his endorsement.
And I just kept thinking, why in the world would you want my endorsement? It didn't make any sense to me. And I just thought, you know, I'm in Gig Harbor. I'm known as a Gig Harbor guy. You're a Tacoma, you know, local elected, or you're running in a different district than mine.
When did you figure it out?
It was actually one of the candidates for mayor actually said, well, I read what you wrote the other day about something, and I finally went, oh.
That's when he found out about the Exit 133 news blog, the other Derek Young, and realized that's who they wanted an endorsement from. Although their orbits have been overlapping for quite a while now, according to Derek the councilman.
For the longest time, we actually hadn't met, but we had very similar circles of friends, so there were a lot of people that knew both of us before we ever met.
And as Derek the Blogger remembers it, it was a little like the Superman Clark Kent thing.
It was actually kind of a joke amongst our friends, is that we would both be invited to the same meeting or the same thing, but somehow one would leave and then the other one would appear, and we were never in the same meeting at the same time.
They finally did meet a few years ago at a fundraiser. Now, one thing that really surprises these two Dereks is that even after people meet them, they sometimes confuse who's who. Here's Derek the blogger.
I've been to meetings before where somebody has pulled me aside and thanked me for all the good work I did in Gig Harbor. And he insists we sat on a panel together.
The strange thing is, though close in age, they're physically quite different.
I might look a little more like a runner than he does.
People that see me would know immediately I'm not a runner.
I am half Asian. He's not. He's you know, 100% Caucasian.
I'm not at all Asian. And that's a pretty big giveaway right there.
Things really got intertwined when Derek the councilman decided to leave the Gig Harbor City Council and run for the Pierce County Council. The rejig district covered parts of Tacoma, where Derek the blogger not only lived but was involved in a lot of civic projects. So when Derek the councilman was out doorbelling...
Typically, if people had heard of me, my first reaction is, do you read Exit 133? And then I would have to explain, well, that's not me.
If things were awkward for Derek the councilman who was running for office, they were even weirder for Derek the blogger, who people assumed was running.
People asked me how the campaign was going. People handed me checks.
Don't worry, he didn't keep them.
I got email messages. I would work with clients and in offices. I would have superiors of mine in offices pull me aside and say, you know, it would have been good if you had told us you were running for office.
Then after the election, when the votes were counted, Derek the councilman won by just 94 votes, beating an incumbent. Now, at that point, Derek the blogger started hearing from friends and friends of friends.
Actually, it was the parents of friends, too. It's the people who are just one step removed from me.
You said you got like 300 congratulations on Facebook?
Yes. 300 via Facebook messages.
So you got him elected, is what you're saying.
I am not saying that because Derek...
No, he's far too modest to say that. Councilman Derek, on the other hand...
I can't give him full credit, but when you have a race that's close, there's a lot of people that can claim credit.
So you won't give him credit for you winning the election?
Actually, I probably should give him full credit for that.
One thing that seems to make this a little easier for both Derek Youngs is that they really are a lot alike when it comes to their politics. Both are liberal, concerned about transportation and environmental issues. So they say the confusion over who someone's voting for isn't that big a deal. That anyone who thought they were voting for Derek the blogger wouldn't be disappointed with Derek the councilman's policies. One thing that's come out of the two sharing the same name is they both have a sense of responsibility towards the other. Derek, the councilman, says he actually felt bad when he decided to run for county council, knowing it might cause disruption in Derek the blogger's life. And now?
You know, every time a controversy pops up, I think, you know, man, I feel a little bad if he's going to get some grief about this.
And for Derek the blogger...
I will get forwarded emails that I shouldn't see. And other things, and it's kind of one of those, this is not intended for me, I'm going to forward it on.
But you run a blog, so you could make use of it. You've chosen not to.
I have chosen not to. And a big part of that is Tacoma's a small community and a small town, and for me to have the trust of people to be able to, you know, help drive the stories and things that we want to do, I'm not going against that trust.
Both insist the whole same name thing is almost always more amusing than frustrating, but I still have a question about the idea of having to share your name.
I was thinking that, like, for my name, Paula Whistle, I haven't met another Paula Whistle. I'm unlikely to, and I've always kind of liked that it's unique, or I feel it's unique, and everybody wants to feel unique, so does this take some of that away?
It makes you more aware of... It's a small world, I'll put it that way.
Or how much we're all alike.
Yeah. You're not the special little snowflake that you thought you were.
And in this age of the selfie, maybe that's the best takeaway of all. You're not that special little snowflake you thought you were.
That story came from KPLU's Paula Whistle. Welcome back to Sound Effect. My name is Gabriel Spitzer, and names are what we're talking about this week. I am going to start this next segment off with a bit of a warning. There's nothing too explicit coming up, but this next interview touches on some very real and very difficult subject matter. So tradition goes that when a man marries a woman, she takes his last name. I mean, doesn't always happen. In fact, it's happening less and less. But for longtime journalist Linda Dahlstrom and her soon-to-be husband Michael Anderson, it just didn't feel right to do that. She didn't feel like she was a different person because she was getting hitched. And anyway, they didn't want to hyphenate. They just decided to keep things as they were. In fact, this became kind of a joke. This supposed Linda Anderson, or worse yet, Mrs. Michael Anderson.
In my mind, she became almost this fictional character. And I pictured her kind of like June Cleaver. I thought she was very tidy. I thought that she probably was very well-groomed and that she cooked well and, in short, all the things that I don't do. And, in fact, one of Mike's coworkers at the time, when she found out he was engaged, she'd said, "Oh, good, now you'll have somebody to cook for you." And he just laughed, and he was like, "You clearly don't know Linda, because I'm a terrible cook, you know, and I actually like it, but I'm horrible at it. I'm terrible at it."
And the idea of Linda Anderson stayed a joke, and she even played with the idea of dressing up as Mrs. Anderson for Halloween one year. So when they got married, Linda Dahlstrom stayed Linda Dahlstrom, and Michael Anderson stayed Michael Anderson. And then they had a son, and they had to give him a name.
Phoenix Lind Anderson. His middle name is actually my family's matriarchal last name in Sweden. Gorgeous little boy, like happiest child anybody had ever met. One of those where you look into his eyes and you just feel like he's really, really there with you, you know? And so much fun. Like, I had no idea how great it was until he arrived.
How well did his name seem to fit him?
Oh, it was actually perfect. We named him Phoenix in honor of the legend of the Phoenix that actually rises from the ashes, because the year before I got pregnant, we'd had a lot of loss. My father died. One of my very best friends died. And we had just been through this really horrible time. And then when we found out we were going to have Phoenix, it was so life-affirming, and it felt like almost a new start. And so that was really the origin of his name. And as soon as we hit upon it, it felt absolutely right for him. And then when we met him, even more so, it seemed perfect.
He inhabited it.
Yeah, yeah.
So what were the baby months like?
It was kind of, it was this crazy, you know, sleep deprived. You just kind of can't believe what is going on. It's this extraordinary experience and frustrating and wonderful all at the same time, but and discovering the world through this little creature, you know, like I have this vivid memory of him learning how to blow raspberries, and I did it, and then he did it back, and it was almost like this moment of first contact where we're communicating in this funny baby language. And and he was really snuggly. He loved to be held. He never was a kid who had that kind of stranger anxiety. Was kind of open to everybody and to the world.
Was it ever weird to have a different last name from your son?
No, I didn't ever think about it, really.
Yeah. So we'll fast forward now. When Phoenix was 7 months old, mm-hmm. what happened?
July 7th in 2005, I woke up early, and he was right next to me in this little co-sleeper, and he was making this noise, it was unusual in it for him. We got up and he was running a fever, and it wasn't even that high for a baby, but he'd never been sick before at all, not even a cold. Like, he was ridiculously healthy. And it just worried me. I kind of had these mom instincts going off. We took him to the emergency room, and they thought that he probably had some kind of a flu or something like that. We were sent home, and then a few hours later, I just knew something wasn't right. And so we actually went back to the pediatrician's office, and she took one look at him and rushed us to the emergency room. And Phoenix died about 5 hours after that. He died of bacterial meningitis, and he died of a rare strain B that there wasn't a vaccine available in this country at that time. And he was gone, and it was about 12 hours from his very first symptom that anything was wrong at all.
It's impossible to imagine or describe an experience like that. I guess just what do you want to say about what it was like to go through that in the immediate aftermath?
It shot me out of everything I knew, everything that I knew about how the world worked, about how my life was, about how the future was going to be. And it catapulted me into this pit of despair. You know, it also, what happened to me is that it stripped down all of the layers of myself just to this really primal being. And I really kind of felt like both Mike and I just sort of operated on instinct. It's like whatever you need to do to get through the day. There were times where I would, almost hallucinate that he was crying or things like that. I would think I would hear him. And, and I never knew really which was worse, to, know that that meant he wasn't really there and that I was hallucinating, and know that that meant I was crazy in some ways. There's this quote from an author I like, Paul Monet, and he said, "Grief is madness," and that really is kind of how it felt. Within that, I found that I was looking for any way I could connect with him. And, I did things like I would sleep with his little clothes. You know, in the mornings, I often couldn't start my day until I got up and did some of the rituals I would have done if he was still alive, picked out his clothes, things like that. And again, the stuff that seems kind of crazy, but it's what I needed to do.
Doesn't seem crazy. The thing you talk about hearing his sort of phantom cries really resonates with me, because when you're a parent, you're so on hair trigger to respond, and you're listening constantly, and you're sort of always on the lookout, and it must be impossible to turn that off.
Yeah, I think so. There's a silence that's really profound, and I think for me, part of that silence too is that people don't really know what to do with a bereaved parent. But one thing that happens is that I think because people are afraid, sometimes they stop bringing up your child, and they stop talking about your child, and they stop saying the name of your child. And I've never yet talked to a bereaved mom who didn't absolutely love to hear the name of her child who died. Like, it's music. It's the most beautiful sound, and it's kind of this rare gift, because people do tend to stop saying it. You know, they're worried they're going to remind you. And I think people don't always understand that there's really no reminding, because you're always aware. You always know. You know in your cells. For me, it's a way to reclaim him. And I think for me, part of that too, when I was looking for all of these ways to connect with him, it's like you're still a mother when your child dies. You know, you're just parenting in a different way. And you have to work a little bit harder at finding those connections. And it's like, you know, I from the moment he died, I always felt him within me. And there is that. But I was also looking for external ways to claim him. And he's buried up at Lakeview Cemetery on Capitol Hill. It's this beautiful historic cemetery. Mike and I have arranged that when we're gone, we're going to also be buried up there with him. And one day I was walking, I was at his grave, and I thought, you know, if people see my name, Linda Dahlstrom, they're not going to connect us. And 100 years from now, if somebody walks by that grave, I wanted them to know that we belong together, that I was his mother. And so that was when I started actually thinking about changing my name. In a weird way, taking his name, not so much Mike's, you know. And so what I ultimately decided to do was take on the last name Anderson. And then I moved my maiden name, Dahlstrom, and made it legally my second middle name. And so my full name now is Linda Annette Dahlstrom Anderson. And so now when people say my name, when they say the name Anderson, they're saying Phoenix's name too. You know, part of it, they don't know. But it helps me feel a connection with him. And I have another son now, Gabriel, who's 8 and is fabulous and so joyful and beautiful. And I have this necklace that I'm actually wearing today that I wear a lot, which is it has little tags. One simply says Phoenix's name and birthday, and the other one says Gabriel's name and birthday. And it was given to me the first Mother's Day after we lost Phoenix, by the facilitator of our grief group, I think, who really understood the importance and the power of the name. And then when we had Gabriel later on, Mike got me one that has his name.
Yeah. I like what you said about, you know, you don't get over a loss like this. You incorporate it into your personhood. And was changing your name a way to incorporate the loss into who you are?
Yeah, I think so. It's really messy. I think nothing about life is cut or dried. Grief, certainly, it's not cut or dried. And, and I think that, like, right now, my name's a little bit fluid. When you asked me when I got here, like, what name, I had to think for a minute. Because typically, you know, I still use Linda Dahlstrom as my byline, where I'm an editor at Fred Hutch. So I still use Linda Dahlstrom professionally, and then I'm Linda Anderson more in my personal life. But then when I do things like this that might melt them, then it gets a little murky.
So you wrote about this experience several years ago, and what kind of response did you get to that writing?
I heard from a lot of bereaved parents who were saying, yes, please say their names, please say their names. And I think for me that was the most important thing, is that is to just put that reminder out there.
Another way that I kind of related to that feeling that you get when people say Phoenix's name, when I had kids, you know, you choose their name and then you create a person with your partner, and then there they are, and there's something that you kind of made up in some ways. To hear other people say their names early on especially was like, ah, they are a real thing in the world. They have their own life. Does that make it real for you in that way?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing, too, that I realized when Phoenix was alive, and certainly after he died, was that Phoenix didn't belong just to Mike and I. Phoenix, we have this beautiful, wonderful, large group of friends and family. Phoenix belonged to all of us. And to this day, you know, our group of friends still talks about him, and a lot of them have photos of him at their houses. And, you know, just this weekend, I got a text from my friend Ann Cotton, who said, hey, I just wanted to let you know, this weekend I've been painting a mural. It's the mascot of my son's school, and it's a phoenix. And I wanted to let you know I was thinking about your phoenix, you know, and again, like, a huge gift.
Well, Linda Annette Dahlstrom Anderson is a writer-editor at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. She's also the mother of Phoenix Lynn Anderson and little Gabriel as well. And she wrote about this originally in an essay for Today Parents, which we'll link to at kplusoundeffect.org. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you, Gabriel.
It's Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we are naming names. So you know the feeling when you go back to your hometown after a few years and nothing's the same? Your favorite restaurant disappeared, or the movie theater is now a Rite Aid or whatever. And like Chrissy Hynde, you find that the city you knew is gone. Well, a few years ago, the Hilltop neighborhood of Tacoma didn't just change. The city wiped it off the map. Austin Hilliker is a Pacific Lutheran University student, and he explored the neighborhood to find out why residents brought the name back and what it means to them.
I'm on the streets of the Tacoma neighborhood, Hilltop, just trying to get a sense of how people feel about their neighborhood. Do you personally like it here in Hilltop?
Yeah, I consider it home now.
Do you worry about the perception of Hilltop at all?
Not now, it's a pretty friendly place.
Several years ago, Tacoma City Council tried to change the name of this area. Have you heard anything about this?
Yeah, I have, actually, and I just don't understand why would you want to do that. Personally, I think that Hilltop has character. Why would you want to change that?
This year marks 4 years since Hilltop reclaimed its name. From 2007 to 2011, the historic area was known as Upper Tacoma. Mike Lonergan was a member of the City Council in 2007 when the name was changed.
There was a group of people, at least, that felt that the name of Hilltop was tarnished. There had been a tremendous amount of gang and drug activity in the Hilltop area. They felt the neighborhood was carrying a stigma that they could remove by changing the name.
Tacoma's drug and gang problem was so bad it even made national news in 1989. That year, a gang called the Hilltop Crips engaged in an infamous shootout with U.S. Army Rangers.
The 80s, that was a rough time.
This used to be a pretty tough area, but it's getting better, I guess. I remember when I was a child and there was a lot of drugs and violence.
Lonergan says business people pushed for the change.
A lot of the impetus was some business people. The idea of the Upper Tacoma Business District as opposed to Hilltop, I think they were interested in being referred to that way, thinking it was more positive.
But even though the name Hilltop had negative connotations, residents didn't want to lose it.
It came down to restoring a sense of pride. It was always called Hilltop. And then when you're going to conferences, they're like, well, where are you from? And you're like, Upper Tacoma Business District. Well, where's that? You know, where's Lower Tacoma? Or, you know, there just would always be some kind of wisecrack.
That's Eric Crittenden. He's former president of Experience Tacoma, which represents businesses in the area. He was a key player in changing the name back to Hilltop in 2011. People living in Hilltop say the area is being revitalized. Mae Harris is treasurer of the Hilltop Action Coalition, a community group working to improve the neighborhood. She says Hilltop has been changing the last few decades, with better schools and more small businesses migrating to the area.
We have more homeowners and professional students up here now, and more families up here. It's a safe area to live, and the crime has gone down. A lot of people are trying to get their kids in here to come to school and stuff, because the educational system is good.
Harris says there are still some youth who try and emulate gang culture, not knowing how violent and terrible it was when gangs were prevalent in Hilltop. But she says the neighborhood is working to raise the kids right.
We still have the kids who think they're gangbangers, but we try and keep them under control. It's not as many drugs as it was.
Michael Schmidtke works for the Basket Nook. The shop has been open for over 60 years on Martin Luther King Jr. Way, which cuts through the middle of Hilltop. Schmidtke says Hilltop isn't that scary anymore.
There's very little to non-existent problems, so the newspapers don't print as much bad press as they used to, so a lot of that's due to this not really having any problems.
And although Hilltop is in the midst of revitalizing, it doesn't get much attention. But for Schmidtke, no news is good news.
The one thing I say is it's not as intimidating, nor is it as scary of a place as a lot of people think it is. It's much safer.
Austin Hilliker is a member of our student reporting internship program at PLU, Pacific Lutheran University. That is going to do it for Sound Effect this week. Our show comes to you from senior producer Arwin Laurelin Hawanakalai Nix III. Arwin, I'm sorry. I think you should turn your mic on for a second.
Hello, Gabriel.
Arwin, I think you need to explain yourself.
I will explain my name.
That will do. Let's start there. Arwin Laurelin Hawanakalai Nix III.
Nailed it.
Where did that come from? Middle Earth?
Yes. Arwin is ripped straight from the pages of J.R.R. Tolkien. I'm named after that character in The Lord of the Rings. And Laurelin is derived also from Tolkien, Lothlorien, Laurelin. Hanukkah or Hwanakalai is a made-up Hawaiian word that I lived most of my life thinking meant volcano on the verge of eruption. And then the internet happened and I looked it up and I realized that my less than sane mother just made it up. And Nix is my family name. And the third is attached to my name and also attached to my brother's name because three is a karmically strong number and it was supposed to bring us fortune and help with our numerology charts.
Just really quickly, does this name feel like a blessing or sort of like a, I don't know, a hump on your back?
Both, I guess. I mean, I've been told my whole life that I should feel special because I have a weird name. So I feel like I should, but I don't. I'd much rather be like Al Johnson or something, but I'm Arwin Nix.
Well, Arwin, I hope you have a daughter someday, and I hope you name her Jane.
No, I'm going to name her Metallica.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Arwin Laurelin Hawanakalai Nix III. We also had help this week from producer Kevin William Frederick Kniestead, production help from Matthew Frederick Stribe, and reporting this week from Paula Renee Whistle and Austin Lee Hilliker. Our executive producer is Aaron and Patricia Hennessy. We had web help from Michael Anthony Lewis and Justin Robert Friedes Steyer. What is with all the aristocratic double middle names around here? Anyway, write us a review on iTunes if you've got something to say. You can also subscribe to our podcast there. Email us at soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU. I will meet you back here next week when we'll have a look at Final Acts.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then you add tap dance to it. And we have it.
I'm Gabriel Ethan Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.